It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Here with the news of the day in two, count them, two pieces of audio. Number one,
we're not just putting higher octane fuel in an old clunker of a tax car. We propose to drive a newer tax car that can compete and win against any country in the world.
Old clunker of a tax car. And then tape number two.
If I am confirmed by the Senate, I will do everything within my power to achieve our congressionally assigned goals of stable prices and maximum employment.
Ah, yes, the dual mandate from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. November the 2nd, Thursday. Good as always to have you along, everybody. A big tax bill out today. A new guy nominated to run the Fed. It is almost more than a business journalist can handle. But duty calls, so off we go. Taxes is where we are going to start, specifically the side of the tax code that corporate America is most interested in. Among the changes the GOP has been pushing hardest on is their plan to cut the corporate tax rate from 35 to 20%. Yes, the tax code is nominally about government revenue. But as Marketplace's Adrian Hill explains to get us going, there's a whole lot more going on with the corporate rate than just a simple cost-benefit thing.
Republicans argue that businesses need a tax cut because our corporate tax rate is at least nominally way higher than most other places in the industrialized world.
The U.S.'s corporate income tax is uncompetitive on the international stage.
Nicole Kading is an economist at the right-leaning Tax Foundation.
We'll see faster economic growth, we'll see higher wage growth, and we'll see a faster pace of job creation.
And the GOP says lower corporate tax rates could also help keep companies in the U.S., stop them from relocating abroad. Other countries have also bought into these arguments.
There's kind of a race to the bottom and a global trend towards lower corporate taxes.
Ed McCaffrey is a law professor at USC.
I do think there's a good bipartisan case to be made to clean up the loopholes and the planning opportunities within the existing corporate tax and bring the rates down.
But he says the bill doesn't go far enough on the cleaning up, the loophole closing. When you shift taxes away from businesses without making big spending cuts, someone's still got to pay. Lawrence Zelenik teaches law at Duke.
It's certainly possible that the end result of this is going to be shifting the tax burden away from capital and almost entirely onto labor.
AKA most of us. He grants there could be economic arguments for reducing corporate taxes, but he says there are also practical political explanations at work here. Corporations have far more effective lobbying strategies than most of us. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Here's today's interesting and handily relevant tax fact. Corporate taxes only account for about 9% of all government revenue, so says the Office of Management and Budget. So we are going to go where the money is, personal federal income taxes and what Republicans want to do there. The thumbnail sketch goes like this: bigger standard deductions, fewer itemized ones, 4 tax brackets instead of the current 7, marginal rates will be 12, 25, 35, and then 39.6% at the top end. How are you going to feel about any of this depends a whole lot on what bracket you fall into, obviously. But as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer explains, today the tax medium becomes the political message.
Rejiggering the tax brackets, that would help some taxpayers. A lot of people would be pushed down into a lower bracket, say from 25% to 12%, because the income levels for the brackets would change.
If I were selling the tax plan, I would make very sure that people understand that the rates are going down for as many taxpayers as I can plausibly claim.
Alex Raskolnikov teaches tax law at Columbia University. He says the same thing goes for the top tax bracket. It wouldn't start until $1 million for a married couple. It used to kick in at a much lower income level. Raskolnikov says brackets make for good marketing. There's just one problem. Most people have no idea what tax bracket they're actually in. As Jeremy Scott of Tax Analysts puts it,
You know, you don't walk around saying, I'm a 25% bracket taxpayer.
If you're in the highest tax bracket, you're likely to know where you stand. But Scott says you may not really care. The wealthy often don't pay income taxes. Many don't get a paycheck. They make their money from investments. Those who do get a salary often also make more from investments.
These are people that are primarily benefiting from stock appreciation, dividends, passive investments, people like the president, quite frankly.
Rich taxpayers would benefit from other parts of the tax overhaul, though, like the repeal of the estate tax. Then there are the approximately 40% of taxpayers who don't pay federal income tax, but they do pay payroll taxes. And the shifting tax brackets won't do anything for them. Mark Weisbrod is with the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
The payroll tax would affect more people, a lot more people than income tax. There's no doubt about that. And this isn't cutting the payroll tax.
That's not likely to be a talking point as the Republicans push their tax bill. It's going to be all about simpler filing, fewer brackets, and lower rates. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
More tax in a bit because, come on, it's tax day, y'all. But on Wall Street this Thursday, sideways, mostly till a bump right at the very end. We'll have the details when we do the numbers.
Taxes are taken out of my check every day that I go to work. So, I mean, getting some of that back in the end of the year, I mean, it really helps out, even though it's not the same. But, you know, a lot of people in my income requirements, you know, depend a lot on their tax return to kind of, like, put them back on that one step forward.
You know, wealthy people made their money and they have a lot. Well, they shouldn't have to part with it just because, they, you know, don't be penalized for that kind of thing.
That was Nancy Cornejo from Washington, D.C., also Carrie Sharps from Philadelphia, P.A. This next thing would be the lead story on any other day, but as we have established, this is not any other economic day. This afternoon, President Trump nominated Jay Powell to succeed Janet Yellen as the chair of the Federal Reserve when Yellen's term expires early next year. In a way, it's a big change without too terribly much of a difference. Ben White is the chief economic correspondent at Politico. Hey, Ben, it's good to have you back.
Great to be here.
The president said very nice things about now outgoing Chair Yellen, said she was a great person, did a great job, and yet he's replacing her. How come?
Yeah, it was weird, Kai, to hear him say, you know, she's a fantastic person, done a terrific job, and yet I'm firing her. He's replacing her because he likes to get rid of anybody who is a holdover from the Obama administration, wants to put his stamp on everything. He also had a problem on Capitol Hill. Republicans wanted to move on from Yellen and would not have been happy if she'd been reappointed. So he picked somebody who's a little bit like Yellen, but is a Republican.
Well, so let's talk about the a little bit like Yellen thing about Jay Powell. First of all, not an economist by training, not that that's necessarily incredibly relevant, but more to the point, his policies are going to be extremely similar. Where then are the differences, if any?
I think the difference will be to a degree in bank regulation. As we know, the Fed does both monetary policy and is the main regulator for some of the country's biggest banks. Jay Powell, a little more friendly to deregulation, getting rid of some of the stuff that we put in place after the financial crisis. So he might differ from Yellen there on monetary policy, rate hikes, be very similar, never voted against her. So it'll be gentle rate hikes over a long period of time, but he might be a little more friendly to Wall Street and quicker to get rid of regulation.
There are other vacancies that President Trump now has on the Board of Governors of the Fed, yeah?
Yeah, he's got a vice chair to fill and at least one other seat to fill, so he can really put a stamp on the central bank.
Can we talk for a minute about the Federal Open Market Committee, which is distinct from the Board of Governors? It's the actual interest rate setting mechanism. Powell's leadership on that committee, it's not like he's going to be able to come in and say, I'm going to do it this way.
That's exactly right. The Fed operates by consensus. One of the reasons he went with Jay Powell is he's known as a collegial guy who's a consensus builder, won't ruffle a lot of feathers, and like Yellen and Ben Bernanke before her, will shepherd the FOMC along to mainly unanimous decisions. So you won't see a lot of discord at the Fed. And that's why he likes Jay Powell, in part because he is a consensus builder.
What's the biggest challenge, before I let you go, that Jay Powell is going to have to deal with in the next 4 years, do you think?
Well, I think the biggest challenge for him will be if we hit another recession. We are long in the tooth in this expansion. Good chance that we get a recession over the next few years. And there's not a lot of room for the Fed to act and counteract that. So what does he do if the economy slows down, unemployment starts to go up? We're at really low rates already. Do we go below zero? Do we do more asset buying? He's going to have a test when the economy slows down and the Fed doesn't have a lot of ammunition at its disposal.
Ben White is the chief economic correspondent at Politico. He had the Jay Powell news like a while ago, right? I mean, you were on this early.
Yeah, we had it about 3 weeks ago. So we were early on the Jay Powell thing, and thank God it actually happened. We didn't have to walk it back.
Ben, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
We had Jay Powell on the program a couple of years ago before he was, you know, somebody. We asked him about the things that really matter in this economy. Here's a hint. It is not just interest rates. You can hear that interview at marketplace.org.
I think I'm still a bit confused as to the messaging of what Congress is actually trying to do. In some ways, it's billed as tax reform and simplifying the process, getting down to what some describe as a postcard. But it seems more recently the messaging has been on cutting taxes.
What I would prefer would be elimination of tax complexity. The tax laws are written in such a way that most ordinary humans couldn't read them if it was presented in front of them, even if they had a master's or a PhD degree.
That was Brian Whedon from Silver Springs, Maryland. Also, Angelo Paparelli from Irvine, California, just down the road. There are two words that are kind of key to figuring out what this tax bill is going to mean for people trying to get by in this economy. Credit, as in tax credits, as in there is a new family credit in this bill, and it expands the child tax credit, also used by a lot of working families. Also, the word exemption, as in personal exemption, as in the exemptions that taxpayers can claim right now for themselves and each of their family members, is going to disappear if this bill passes. Marketplace's Amy Scott explains what all that is going to mean.
First, a little refresher. A tax credit reduces how much tax you owe, dollar for dollar. A deduction lowers your taxable income, so you only get a percentage back, depending on how much you earn. Veronique DeRougy is a fellow with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University.
No matter how you look at it, a tax credit is always more money in your pocket.
If you qualify for the credit, that is, the House Republican bill proposes raising the child tax credit to $1,600 per child, up from $1,000. Some of that credit is refundable, meaning people who don't pay that much in taxes still get some of the money. But Chuck Marr with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities says 16 million low-wage working parents won't see any increase.
Picture a single mom works for minimum wage. They specifically designed the bill so she gets nothing from this increase. Whereas a couple making $200,000 would get $3,200 in new child tax credits.
That's for two kids. But middle-class families would also lose several deductions. For example, right now, taxpayers can take a personal exemption of up to $4,050 per person in the family. An exemption works like a deduction, reducing your taxable income. To make up for some of that, the bill adds a new family credit of $300 for each taxpayer, spouse, and older dependent in a household. But Lily Batchelder, a professor of law and public policy at NYU, says that expires after 5 years.
It's a bit of a bait and switch because they're taking away a big benefit for middle-class families and allowing to expire one of the things that is replacing it.
So under the House plans, some credits go up, some deductions shrink or disappear. Who comes out ahead will depend a lot on their individual circumstances, where they live, how many kids they have, and of course, how much they earn. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
I really think we should be thinking about where our taxes go more than the money in our own pockets. I don't mind paying my taxes, but I mind what that money funds, and I really care deeply about that.
Bottom line is I'd like to pay less. I mean, I'm just going to bottom line it. It matters, you know, to pay 40, 50% of my income is a little crazy.
That was Catherine Snyder in Philadelphia, also Ken Wolf from New York. Coming up now.
There's a reason why people in Broomfield are making our own laws, and that's because no one else is doing it for us.
Drill, baby, drill? Yeah, but not so fast. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 81 points today, about 0.3%, 23,516. NASDAQ off a point, basically unchanged, 67.14. The S&P 500 also unchanged, 25.79. With all the talk about tax changes, a look at the tax industrial complex now. The company's doing the calculating of the tax time, at tax time, rather. H&R Block trickled down 2.5%. Liberty Tax boosted 2.33%. Intuit, the company that makes tax prep and accounting software, clicked up about 0.5% today. Home builders just got slammed with the Republican proposal capping the popular home mortgage interest deduction. Home builder Meritage Homes, or Meritage perhaps, pounded down 4.8%. Home construction firm D.R. Horton slid 0.2% today. Bonds up, yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.34%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million-dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out Public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. For those keeping score at home so far on this GOP tax day, we have ticked off simplifying tax brackets, lowering the corporate tax rate and credits and exemptions. Now, deductions. The bill as written right now, and this is probably a good point to mention that today is not the end of the wrangling on this bill at all. Actual hearings start on Monday. But as written, this bill gets rid of deductions for state and local income taxes. It'd cap state and local property tax deductions, and it would limit the mortgage interest deduction by capping it at $500,000 for future home purchases. Here, though, is the deal. All of these provisions are going to have a bigger impact in some parts of the country than in others. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson rolls out the economic map.
Dear dedicated Joel Slamrod devoted a chunk of his day to going through the 400-odd pages of this bill. He's an economics professor at the University of Michigan.
There are provisions about oil and gas, about energy credits, timber. There's a limit on wagering losses. There's a provision for no more tax-exempt bonds for stadiums.
He says those parts will affect some areas more than others, but the regional biggies are definitely provisions around eliminating state and local deductions and decreasing the mortgage interest deduction.
If you look at the numbers, the states where the state and local deduction as a share of income is very high, it's New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and California. Where it's very, very low, it's Wyoming, South Dakota, and North Dakota.
Anything strike you about those two groups?
There is certainly a red-blue difference between those states.
Clearly, that was not lost on the politicians drafting this bill, Slamrod says. But he cautions there are also Republican congressmen in those states that the GOP will want to keep on board to pass this bill. Alan Viard is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute.
The Republicans have defended cutting back on the deduction for state and local taxes and cutting back on the mortgage deduction on the grounds that those deductions primarily benefit higher income taxpayers. There's certainly a considerable element of truth to that. Of course, there may be indirect effects.
Like?
It makes raising revenue at the state and local level more difficult.
Carl Davis, the research director at the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, says federal deductions can blunt high state taxes. But repealing those deductions will generate significant revenue.
Revenue that can be put towards any variety of causes. In this case, the cause happens to be mainly tax cuts for corporations and other business owners, as well as for large estates.
So how you feel about this tax bill may well depend on where you live. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Tax reform is something that concerns me, mainly because I'm one of the people that would benefit from it, but I know that there are so many others that would suffer from it. I feel like we've been sold a bill of goods. I'm not buying it. As to the middle class benefiting, I don't see that happening in this particular plan.
You know, they say we're broke and all these taxes are for this issue or another, but in reality, I don't know where my money's going.
That was Laura Bordeaux from Atlanta, also Fernando Robledo from Los Angeles. I don't know if you've noticed, but just to change the subject a little bit, oil has been on something of a ride lately, almost $55 a barrel today at the close in New York. That's a 30% bump from the lows that crude hit this past summer. I mention that because those rising prices, in the way that capitalism has, bring with them more drilling, an economic reality that's playing out in the politics of a suburb north of Denver. The oil and gas industry is spending hundreds of thousands of dollars fighting a measure on the ballot next Tuesday that could mean more local control over drilling. It's part of a much larger fight over health and safety policy and state law that's playing out across northern Colorado as oil and gas development moves in. Lee Patterson with the public media collaboration Inside Energy reports.
Mackenzie Carignan drives me past street after street of new development homes with a view of mountains in the distance. Carignan lives here in Broomfield, Colorado, and she's moving.
That's my new house. That's the back of it.
And when her family moves, they'll still be in Broomfield, but much closer to a new oil and gas project. It calls for drilling 84 wells in the city. And this is happening a lot north of Denver. Population is booming, and so is oil and gas.
It's only common sense that there's going to be this conflict between housing developments and oil and gas developments.
Many residents feel that state regulations just aren't good enough to protect neighborhoods near drilling.
There's a reason why people in Broomfield are making our own laws. And that's because no one else is doing it for us.
She's talking about ballot question 301. She supports it. The measure would require the city council to take the health and safety of residents into account when considering new oil and gas development. It doesn't sound like a big deal, but pro-drilling groups are fighting it hard, raising around $345,000 worth of cash and in-kind support. They're spending on things like this TV ad featuring former Colorado Governor Bill Owens.
301 doesn't protect people. It's a cynical power play focused on blocking energy development, period.
Plus Facebook ads, robocalls, mailers, and canvassing.
And of course, gas and oil will spend, by and large, what it takes.
Floyd Cerulli is an independent political pollster based in Denver. He's not doing any work on this ballot question directly, but is familiar with the fight by industry to stop it.
I think their feeling is that if they lose one city, they will lose many cities.
So far, the fight against 301 has been funded by two main groups, the Colorado Petroleum Council and a pro-drilling nonprofit called Vital for Colorado. The Petroleum Council didn't respond to my request for an interview. Vital did, via email, explaining that the group opposes all efforts to, quote, cripple one of the state's most important economic sectors through campaigns at the state and local level. Floyd Cerulli says that what happens on oil and gas issues here in Colorado,
it could affect other state politicians. It could actually create a dialogue nationally. And so their goal is to try and win as much as possible.
The conflict here is getting more and more intense thanks to a powerful mixture of factors. Colorado's history of local control, its strong environmental values, and that growth in population and drilling in the same place at the same time. But here's the thing about ballot question 301. It's tricky, because any limitation the city puts on drilling could conflict with state regulations, and state regulations preempt local rules when it comes to oil and gas. In Broomfield, Colorado, I'm Lee Patterson for Marketplace.
All in all, the biggest problem with this proposal is that it's not transparent. Nobody knows what it's going to do. It makes us a living petri dish. It's like they're going to come out with this plan, and we won't know whether it's good for working class, good for middle class.
It impacts how I think about saving for my retirement. It impacts how I think about purchasing real estate or not, or how I'm going to purchase it, how I'm going to title it, or if I'm going to use it for investment property. It impacts a lot of my decisions.
That was Nick Boxer from Atlanta, also Lily Burton from Altadena, California. This final note on the way out today, picking up on something the House Ways and Means Committee put on its briefing sheet for the tax bill, talking about some of the changes to corporate tax policies, pass-throughs specifically, that let businesses pass through earnings to be taxed at a lower personal rate. The committee says it's going to have safeguards in place to make sure that small businesses benefit, distinguishing, the committee wrote, between the paycheck that NBA All-Star Steph Curry gets and the business income of Steve's Bike Shop.
Steve's Bike Shop?
Hey, it's Kai Rizdahl at Marketplace. I'm looking for Steve.
Speaking.
Hey, Steve, how are you?
Well, I'm a little bit starstruck.
that's very nice of you to say. How big is the shop? How many people you have working there?
Well, it's just myself and my family, so we try to keep it tight and keep the overhead low.
How's business, by the way? How's the bike shop business?
Well, the bike industry is a little bit low right now. It's everyone's trying to figure out more or less what's going on, and you can point fingers at anything from Amazon to, well, you can point fingers at anything you want, actually, but
yeah.
It's really hard to say.
So have you been following the tax debate at all?
I have, as closely as possible when I'm not fixing bikes, yeah.
So one of the things that's in this bill is a pass-through provision, right? That's what it's called. And it would let certain kinds of business owners take their corporate taxes, their business taxes, at a much lower rate. And I'm wondering, first of all, do you do that, whether you know you do that or not? And what would that mean for you?
Well, if I was doing that and if it was continuing to do that, I think that's just more money in my pocket, which ends up in my family's pocket. And that's I'll take it where I can get it.
Scale of 1 to 10, how important is tax reform to you as a small business owner in the United States?
Well, I'd like to say it's a 10. I want to see everybody try to benefit from this as much as possible. And, yeah.
Steve, that's great. I appreciate your time.
Kai, I'm thoroughly honored.
Terrific. Have a nice day, sir. Steve Salinas right there, the owner-operator of Steve's Bike Shop up in Altadena, California. All right, that's a wrap on Tax Day. The Dow up 81.3%. NASDAQ and the S&P 500 essentially unchanged. It's a wrap on Tax Day, but certainly not on tax coverage because, you know. Anyway, John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Urbe, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Tro are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor for a little while longer is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.